Hi, everyone. TD Bank faces historic penalties for the failure of its anti-money laundering program. We're going to discuss what went wrong and what you can learn from it. I'm your host, Bill Coffin, and this is the Ethicast. TD Bank, the 10th largest bank in the U.S., has pleaded guilty to historic charges involving its role as the money laundering venue of choice for narcotics traffickers. According to the DOJ, quote, TD Bank intentionally did not automatically monitor all domestic automated clearinghouse transactions, most check activity, and numerous other transaction types, resulting in 92% of total transaction volume going unmonitored from January 1st, 2018 to April 12, 2024. This amounted to approximately $18.3 trillion of transaction activity, end quote. To put that figure into perspective, the 2024 GDP of China is $18.5 trillion. As a result, the bank became a go-to money laundering platform, and between January 2018 and January 2021, money laundering networks funneled $670 million through the bank, with $470 million of that by just one money laundering network. Most of this activity was on behalf of large-scale drug trafficking. To quote U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, by making its services convenient for criminals, TD Bank became one. The charges are the result of a coordinated effort between the U.S. Department of Justice, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Board, as well as the Treasury Department's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, and Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN. TD Bank will pay a fine of $1.8 billion to the Justice Department, $1.3 billion to FinCEN, and $450 million to the OCC. It will also retain an independent compliance monitor for 3 years, remediate and enhance its AML compliance program, operate under a $434 billion asset cap, and face stricter regulation within the United States. These conditions all reflect that the bank received partial credit for its cooperation in the investigation, even though it did not disclose in a timely fashion. In a statement, TD Bank CEO Bharat Masrani said, quote, "This is a difficult chapter in our bank's history. These failures took place on my watch as CEO, and I apologize to all our stakeholders," end quote. Given the scope of all this, that might be the ethics and compliance understatement of the year. With us to explain what all of this means for TD Bank and what larger ethics and compliance lessons we can learn from it is Ethisphere Chief Strategy Officer, Erica Salmon Byrne. Erica, welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you so much for having me. Always a delight to do one of these Reacts episodes.
Well, before we begin, I think it's important to point out that it was only a few months ago when you and I got together to talk about Boeing's plea deal. And, you know, we take no particular pleasure in discussing large corporate compliance failures, but really it's more about every situation like this points the way to best practices that can help everyone, including TD Bank, avoid future situations like this one.
Yep, absolutely, Bill. And in fact, not only do you and I feel that way strongly, but we now know that the Department of Justice agrees with us. Because if you look at the most recent updates to the evaluation of corporate compliance programs, one of the things that the department said in that update was companies should be learning from not only their own issues, but also the challenges and mistakes of others in their industry. So I think, you know, anytime you see something like this happen, it really is incumbent on all of us to say, could it happen here? What would it look like? What sort of lessons can we learn by digging into this particular fact pattern and the resolution that TD Bank just entered into?
Ultimately, TD Bank is going to pay about $3 billion in fines. It's the largest banking fine we've ever seen. But the bank is liquid enough to pay it by only reducing its assets by 10%. So this feels like if TD Bank were a person, it would be like selling one of your cars to pay, you know, a large traffic fine or something.
Yep.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says that TD Bank got off easy here. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's the age-old debate, Bill, between with anytime we talk about any of these corporate resolutions. You know, it's the one of the weird things about our particular setup, you know, here in the U.S. and then and really in any country with a similar legal system, where the corporation is a thing, right? It can sue, it can be sued, it can engage in criminal activity, but you can't put it in jail. You know, you can't, you know, the only thing the department can do, any of the regulators can do, is either fine them, require that they have a monitor, which they will be paying for, and they do in this particular case. And then the other piece that I think is very interesting is limit their ability to expand here in the US until these issues are resolved. So there's the fine piece, which incidentally, the more the bank claws back from employees involved or tangentially involved in the misconduct, that fine will go down over time. So we will have to see what the actual fine amount ends up being. There's the fees for the monitor. There's the money they're going to have to pay to upgrade their program and invest in the way that they should have been investing all along. And then there's also the impact it's going to have on their ability to expand here in the United States. They just announced a couple of weeks ago that they have new heads of the U.S. banking business. So the prior head was exited from the organization. They have new heads of the U.S. banking business, and that those heads are going to be curtailed by the resolution of their misconduct.
You know, when you see a large organization like this take a fine of that size, the fine in absolute terms is a huge amount of money, but maybe not relative to the organization being fined. But at the same time, and this is something you and I speak about an awful lot, when you have situations like this, we're talking about companies with huge numbers of employees, and almost all of them did nothing wrong here. This is the wrongdoing of a relatively small group of people, some of them rather senior, but the people directly involved in this are rather small. And it's like, the company needs to pay, but there are innocent people within that company as well. And if the company pays too much, it can't do any good down the line, right? You know, ultimately. So how does it best benefit society by burning it down?
But one of the things that really stood out to me, Bill, in reading over both the fact pattern and the settlement documents was the fact pattern came about because of this practice that TD Bank had publicly announced of, I believe they called it flat budgeting in the word, where basically they weren't going to invest anymore in control functions, even though the bank grew. And on its face, I mean, come on, that is, that is risk management 101, that you can't drastically grow your commercial business and then not at all grow your risk controlling functions. And really, you know, shame on the leadership at TD Bank and the board for that matter, for thinking that they were going to be able to keep the bank out of trouble without spending any more on control functions.
Bharat Masrani announced in September that he was retiring effective next April to be succeeded by Raymond Chun, Group Head, Canadian Personal Banking. Both of those executives had been with the bank for more than 30 years. Masrani has been CEO for 10. And all that time includes, you know, during the entire timescape of this compliance failure. What questions should TD Bank's board be asking right now? And what broader governance lessons are we to learn from all this?
I think the board should be asking a lot of questions, Bill. I think the board should be asking questions of the leadership team along the lines of, you know, how did you think that growing the commercial business without growing the risk control functions was going to keep the bank out of trouble? Did you consider the extent to which we were exposing ourselves to money laundering risk? And if not, why not? I think there needs to be a very hard and very robust conversation around the extent to which the bank thinks that helping Chinese criminals launder fentanyl money is a bad thing. Because one of the things that did not happen in the statement that TD Bank's CEO issued, that you called the ethical understatement of the century, which I agree with, there was no real reflection of the fact that the money laundering rules exist for a reason. It's because we're trying to keep bad people from being able to use their money that was earned in bad ways. And, you know, that is a kind of a fundamental regulatory cornerstone of banking. And I am curious what kind of internal conversations were happening at TD Bank about the fact that that was a risk that they were not really controlling for. And honestly, in many ways, knowingly doing so, because for 10 years, they didn't invest in compliance and risk control functions at all. So I think there need to be a lot of really robust conversations inside the organization. And honestly, depending on the monitor that they end up working with, I think those conversations are going to have to happen, because it is one of those, money laundering is one of those regulatory places where, particularly the kind of money laundering we're talking about here, like there's some human impact from allowing someone to engage in that kind of behavior in the confines of your bank. And I think that there needs to be a real conversation at the board level from a stakeholder perspective to say, are we okay with this? I mean, you know, TD Bank has a robust history in Canada. You know, the Canadian government has brand new human trafficking law that is in effect. And we know that one of the things that drug trafficking money supports is human trafficking. So I think there's a lot of questions that the team at TD Bank should be asking themselves.
What questions should we be asking the board itself? I mean, they were also here for this. There are questions they could have been asking and did not. And we talk about that flat budgeting strategy. They were there for that as well.
For any public company, the remedy for directors not upholding their obligations to shareholders is replacement of the directors. I also would be stunned, Bill, if we don't see derivative litigation as a result of this settlement, particularly given the involvement of senior people in the fact pattern at issues. You know, I'm confident that is coming for TD Bank. I think the question that I would push them on is, what metrics were you looking at over the course of 10 years that were giving you comfort that you were upholding your regulatory obligations, right? What information was coming to you from risk and compliance functions, from internal audit, from finance, that were telling you that this was okay? Because the settlement makes it pretty clear that there were internal folks at TD Bank that were raising their hand and saying, this isn't working, this isn't okay, bad stuff is happening, you know, things are going wrong. And either those things didn't make it to the board level, in which case the board should ask itself why, or even worse, it made it to the board level and the board decided they didn't care. And, you know, we weren't there. We don't know which one of those two things it was, but internal people raised their hand. External auditors raised their hand. Those hands being raised were ignored over the course of the last several years. And so, you know, there needs to be some real soul searching at the board level as to why.
If I could pursue the budgetary aspect of this a little bit further, as part of its settlement, TD Bank will hire more than 700 new specialists to bolster its AML efforts. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the budgeting decisions that led to this critical shortage of monitoring bandwidth in the first place? And I think more importantly, what compliance programs can do to prevent that from happening at their own organizations? I mean, budgets are tightening everywhere. Yep. So saying it can never happen here is kind of a non-starter.
The big thing that TD Bank clearly did not do in this process from a budget setting perspective was, over the course of the last decade, their risk mitigation functions did not keep pace with the growth of the bank. And so the first thing I would say is budgeting has to be risk-based. And if you were growing quickly in locations where there are, you know, in high-risk jurisdictions, you need to, A, redo your risks, right? Which we know from the settlement TD Bank didn't do. There was no kind of redoing of risk ranking. You need to look at risk by customer, and you need to look at your regulatory environment. If your budgeting is not keeping pace with the way in which the company's risks are changing, I don't care what business you're in, you're going to wind up eventually having an issue. So thinking about risks, making sure you're keeping pace. And then look, the ECCP talks about the fact that the government's going to look at the extent to which the company has invested in risk and control functions compared to commercial functions, right? That was one of the edits we saw in September to the ECCP. And Bill, as you and I have talked about, the ECCP edits generally track the significant settlement agreements that the department has learned from over the course of the period since the last update. And so I think we can say with a fair degree of confidence that the combination of TD Bank and Boeing has really caused the department to look very carefully at this ratio of investment compared to commercial functions to make sure that the growth is not going to be one-to-one. You know, look, we don't live in that world. I'm not expecting that, you know, for every dollar you spend on new market acquisition, you're going to spend an equivalent dollar on compliance, but it should not be 0-1. Right? There is a ratio in there that is the right ratio for your organization. And figuring out what that right ratio looks like is a really important piece of the puzzle. Bill, I want to go back though quickly to the question about TD Bank's ownership and the shareholder piece. So if you look at the mix of companies that hold significant investments in TD Bank, there are some very large names on this list who are banks themselves. And so, you know, I think another really important question to be asking here is, what did Royal Bank of Canada know about how TD Bank was approaching risk mitigation and money laundering controls? What did Bank of Montreal know? What did Vanguard know? You know, there are some very large institutional investors that are significant shareholders in TD Bank, you know, CIBC World Markets, you know, the Bank of Nova Scotia. There should be some soul searching there as well to think about, what did we know? What questions did we not ask that we should be asking to make sure that we are not, put in a position where our reputations are tied to a bank that engaged in issues with money laundering that are as egregious as these.
One of the most amazing parts of this whole thing to me was how rank and file TD Bank employees themselves took substantial bribes to help launder money. At one point, DOJ mentioned, I think $57,000 in gift cards were given to kind of, you know, grease the wheels. And that strikes me as a high frequency, low severity aspect of bribery. So I guess my question is, how does an organization of this size reset culturally to prevent this kind of misconduct from recurring?
They've got to take a real hard look at their really everything from a compliance perspective inside of TD Bank. And in particular, every company on the planet in their code of conduct says gift cards, accepting gift cards is a violation of our code. Who knew that this was happening? Who saw it happening? In some cases, the fact pattern says that employees use the same debit cards that they sent to Colombian drug cartel members to take their piece of the pie. Obviously, there was a look the other way element of this. People had to know that that was happening and chose not to say anything. But also, I think, you know, there's a definite element of this that is, you know, what happened to the people who did raise their hand and say, we're not keeping up with our risks? What happened to the people who said, you know, our controls are not keeping pace with the growth of the business? I think the monitor that comes in needs to look really carefully at the cultural aspects of this, at the willingness of people to say what's happening in their particular branches. Because anytime that you have an organization of this size, you're going to wind up with some people who are open to a bribe to look the other way. And so you have to rely on your systems and your controls to be able to catch those kinds of circumstances. And in this case, from what I can tell, there simply weren't any.
You know, we talked about this earlier this year in our culture report, and we talked about the speak up gap, and something like, I think it's like 93% of people say they'd be willing to report misconduct when they see it. When the moment of truth happens, that number drops to 50%. And when you ask people why, it's because they are afraid of retaliation or they're afraid nothing's going to happen as a result of it. As TD Bank does a cultural stock taking, if you will, I'd be curious to know what those numbers look like within TD Bank. I think that might be a really interesting indicator of the health of speak up culture with regards to, you know, how much that deteriorated because the, you know, bribery culture came up, or if simply other factors were keeping it low and that helped the bribery culture come up. I think there's correlation is not always causation, but I'd be curious to see what causalities there could be here. They might be significant.
Inside of any organization, your culture is a combination of your formal systems and your informal systems. Your informal systems are always going to be stronger than your formal systems, right? Your informal systems of sort of how do we do things here, the things that people are not, you know, willing to challenge, the unspoken rules of a particular manager or a particular team or a particular piece of the organization. But when you have really weak formal systems, your informal systems are really going to triumph, right? And so I think one of the things that we see in this particular circumstance is a deliberate underinvestment with a name on it, right? A deliberate underinvestment of in the formal systems coupled with informal systems that can exist inside any organization. And so, you know, to those out there listening to this and thinking to themselves, well, my formal systems are stronger than TD Bank's formal systems, so I'm all good. That's probably true, but that's not a real high bar for you to be stepping over. And B, you know, all of us can benefit from spending some time thinking about the ways in which our informal systems may be either augmenting or undermining the formal systems that we've put in place at our organizations.
What is it that Matt Galvin said at the GES? What's the definition of culture?
Culture is the worst behavior an organization will tolerate.
TD Bank's stock dropped some 6% after the DOJ's announcement, in part because of the news of the imposed asset cap, which will make growth more difficult for the bank. We talk about the ethical pillar of pressure quite a lot. How can TD Bank best meet the challenges that will come with addressing internal corruption and resetting its culture, all while facing the kind of marketplace pressure that can incubate internal ethical pressure?
From significant misconduct sometimes comes the very best cultures and programs, right? Because people suddenly wake up to the real human cost of this. And so if I were arriving at TD Bank tomorrow as their monitor, one of the things that I would really talk about is, why do we have money laundering regulations in the first place, right? What is the purpose of trying to prevent people from being able to launder money? What's the point of it? Because I think there are, there's an element of, well, that's a silly reg, or that's getting in the way of business, you know, that sort of thing. So really taking it back to the why, right? Why do we have these rules in the first place? Why do we have these elements in place inside of our regulatory system? What is the harm, the actual human harm that we are trying to prevent with these regs? Because you've got to hook the hearts and minds of people who have been accustomed to doing things a certain way. And then you need to look hard at the formal systems, and you need to make sure that your incentives are set up appropriately. You need to make sure that you are thinking about the ways in which your risk mitigating activities can actually be commercially value creating. And again, the what they have lived through is an excellent example of this, right? They are going to be regulatorily prevented from doing certain kinds of business because of their failures. And if you can't make some hay out of that, as a monitor or as a compliance team, then shame on you, right? There's that is an element of, you know, really clearly saying to the new commercial heads of the US business are 3 weeks into their role. And you're saying basically to them, you are going to run this race with both hands tied behind your back because of the history of what the bank has done.
Well, Erica, thank you so much for joining us and for providing your insight on this historic case.
Oh, Bill, it's my pleasure. There's a lot for us to talk about here. I'm sure that there is going to be more to come in terms of details as this story continues to develop. And I hope that everybody listening can, you know, think about at least one way in which some of this could happen inside your organization and take this as an opportunity to do that kind of self-examination.
To read the full text of the DOJ's announcement, visit www.justice.gov. This case is currently on its homepage, but we will link directly to the announcement in the show notes of this episode. For a wealth of helpful, free resources on best practices around anti-money laundering, anti-bribery, anti-corruption, and the pillars of an ethical culture, please visit the Ethisphere Resource Center at ethisphere.com/resources. Also, this case directly reflects the updated guidance of the DOJ's Evaluation of Corporate Compliance Programs. Erica and I did an episode on that recently, which we encourage you to watch. We'll include a link to that episode as well. I'm Bill Coffin, and this has been the Ethicast. For more episodes, please visit the Ethisphere YouTube channel at youtube.com/ethisphere. And if this is your first time enjoying the show, please make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, remember, strong ethics is good business.